Thank you very much. Thanks for organizing this whole thing. Thanks to Vladimir and Brian. It's very nice to be here. So the title of my talk is Hydrodynamics and its Destruction. So this will be an overview of several topics that I have recently worked on and several, you know, things that have been going on in the field of hydrodynamics and in going beyond hydrodynamics. So this is a collection of works done in collaboration with my PhD supervisor, Andrei Starinets, and another postdoc who was in Leiden, Nikos Kaplis. Then there will be a section that was done in collaboration with people from Amsterdam, Nabil Iqbal and Diego Hoffman. And also, if I have time, I will also discuss some things that were done in collaboration with people in Leiden, so Konrad Halm and the group at Harvard, Sudhir Sachdev and his PhD student, Andy Lucas. So we'll see how far we can get. Now, the rough outline of this whole talk is as follows. I will start by discussing hydrodynamics from the point of view of field theory. In particular, I want to focus on two things. I want to focus on going beyond Navier-Stokes equations, and as the main application that I'm going to present here, I want to talk about magnetohydrodynamics. Okay, and then I want to go beyond this and talk about hydrodynamics from the point of view of holography, ADS-CFT. In particular, I want to discuss some new results and some new understanding of these topics that we have regarding dependence of observables on the coupling of the theory. And in particular, I also want to discuss some of the universalities that we have learned about at strong coupling. Then, in the context of universality and hydrodynamics in holography, I will briefly discuss how we have recently been able to use hydrodynamic insight to say things about strongly disordered condensed matter systems. After that, I want to go beyond hydrodynamics and discuss sort of higher frequency spectrum, the whole thing, not just focusing on the low energy limit of the theory. In particular, I want to discuss thermalization and how we can observe breakdown of hydrodynamics as we go towards weak coupling from the point of view of holography. So this is the rough outline of the story. So I'm going to start with hydrodynamics from the point of view of field theory. So let me just, as the usual motivation for the story, why do we care in high energy community, for example, about hydrodynamics? It's more than just, you know, curiosity in terms of how effective field theories work. In particular, there's a very nice application, and this is QCD. So when people do heavy ion collision experiments in CERN or at RIC, what they observe is that after the collision of two nuclei, there's a state of matter formed, which is called the quark-gluon plasma, and the dynamics of this quark-gluon plasma, even though this is a high-energy process, is very well described by hydrodynamics. So this is certainly one of the motivations, and I hope to complete the story by coming back to this. So this is a sort of nice schematic of what happens in these setups, experimental setups, where two heavy ion nuclei are collided. So how I want to think about hydrodynamics is from the point of view of a low-energy effective field theory. So what we do in hydrodynamics is first we identify global conserved operators. So in the simplest case, there's just a conserved energy and momentum. So there's a corresponding stress-energy tensor. And what we do then, we identify the appropriate degrees of freedom, low-energy degrees of freedom, in terms of which we want to classify this theory. And then we write down a gradient expansion. So in the simplest case, where I just have a fluid at finite temperature, so I can forget about any chemical potential because I don't have any charge for the moment, the degrees of freedom that are necessary for me to solve the equations of hydrodynamics, which are just the conservation of energy. So if I look at four-dimensional world, I can see that I need to solve four differential equations. So this means that I need four degrees of freedom to solve such a system.
You're assuming isotropic stresses?
Yes.
Is that true for quark-gluon plasmas?
This is now sort of starting from zero. For quark-gluon plasma, maybe no. So this is now, I'm just constructing from the beginning, hydrodynamics. Yeah, I'm not talking about quark-gluon plasma yet. No, quark-gluon plasma is not isotropic. The relevant degrees of freedom for a flow are, of course, its velocity profile. And now, if I take my relativistic velocity u mu, it's normalized to minus 1. So this only gives me 3 degrees of freedom. So I need an extra scalar. And for me, this extra scalar will be some off-equilibrium generalization of the temperature field. Or equivalently, you can think about an energy density field. So then I write down the gradient expansion because of this, because of the low energy theory. So the most general thing I can write down at zeroth order in derivatives, counting derivatives on mu and on t, are these two terms. I'm putting my fluid on a curved background metric. So the two coefficients in front can be any functions. They can be anything. I don't know what they are. Now, they're conventionally called the energy density and pressure. Then I go on and I start classifying. I write down all possible tensor structures that are consistent with symmetry, and I write down my most general stress energy tensor. So at first order in this expansion, there are two terms that I can write down. There's a term with sigma. Sigma is the relativistic shear tensor, and this is a divergence of the vector field. So these two terms correspond to what we know as viscous corrections. So again, I don't know what the prefactors are, but I can associate these transport coefficients with each term. So in the most general case, we have a shear viscosity and a bulk viscosity. What I do then in hydrodynamics, I plug this into conservation equation, and this gives me my relativistic version of Navier-Stokes equations. So then I can try to solve this. Now the important point here is that hydrodynamics is a combination of two things. One is a phenomenological effective field theory expansion, by just counting tensor structures. Now, I cannot do very much with this unless I know what the relations of these functions, shear viscosity, bulk viscosity, are as a function of temperature or charges, chemical potentials of my theory, because I will not be able to close these equations. So for this, I need an equation of state, and I need the knowledge of transport coefficients. And this can only come from some kind of microscopics.
What's so, capital delta?
Oh, capital delta is a projector. So this is just UU plus G. It's a it's a transverse projector. So two directions transverse to the vector field. Okay, so there's a particular class of hydrodynamic theories that I will be considering later, which will be the conformal Weyl covariant theories. They're characterized by vanishing trace of the stress energy tensor. This is in the absence of Weyl anomaly, for example. And in order for this to be Weyl covariant, if I perform such a local Weyl transformation on the metric, in four dimensions, my stress energy tensor has to transform in such a way. And this is able to constrain lots of transport coefficients. And I will be using this later. So now, in principle, what I can do in hydrodynamics, if I have the power to do this, I can write down all possible structures by just counting the numbers of derivatives acting on my fields. And I can write down this infinite order series. And then, for example, a nice observable is to look at what happens to the modes in the system. So I can plug in some background value for my fields and, you know, times it with e to the minus I omega t plus I kx. And then I can try to solve my conservation equations for this. And I want to read off the modes of the system. So in the end, I can end up with an equation that looks like this. So omega frequency can be written as a function of k, expanded to, in principle, infinite order. Now, what we have learned recently is that this doesn't really make sense. So hydrodynamics is not a convergent series. In fact, it's quite similar to what happens in QED. So this series, expansion in k, is an asymptotic series. So there's a question. What is sort of the sensible order to which one should expand in? This is not known, and there's been a lot of progress recently done by people like Heller, and there's also groups in Poland. But I will not talk too much about these issues. I will assume that, you know, I can write down an infinite order expansion for now, and just assume that I can solve such a thing, and, you know, as we all know, there are these problems with asymptotic expansions, but this will not be relevant for now. So in principle, the question is how many of these tensors I can write down at each order. And this is, of course, a very difficult computational problem. So as I already wrote down on the previous slide, at first order, there are two transport coefficients, shear and bulk viscosities. If one imposes Weyl covariance, bulk viscosity drops out. There's only shear viscosity. So in second order hydrodynamics, there are 15 such terms you can write down. Only five of them contribute to a CFT. What we wrote down with Nikos Kaplis was a computer program to generate this kind of an expansion at higher order. So it turns out that at third order, there are 68 such tensors, and only 20 of them survive in a CFT. So now you may ask, why would
I... Sorry, you're in three space-time dimensions?
3 plus 1.
3 plus 1?
Like the world.
Why is there no anomaly for this rest tensor?
There is. So there's an anomaly that goes, so the right-hand side is proportional to r squared. So this r squared term, and this would only enter in fourth order hydrodynamics because fluctuations, so derivatives of the fluctuations of the metric normally are counted as the same size as the, you know, delta U and delta T and delta G are of the same size. So r squared goes as derivative to the fourth. So a Weyl anomaly only contributes to fourth order hydro. This we know, and we can, you know, incorporate this into the series. You're right. I mean, to this order, this is not relevant. Okay, so a nice example of where, for example, third-order hydrodynamics already kicks in is diffusion. So if you compute corrections to diffusion, you know that diffusive transport has a normal mode or quasi-normal mode that looks like omega equals to minus id times k squared. So the next-order correction goes as k to the fourth, and this the coefficients that enter into this correction depend both on second and third order transport coefficients. So for example, perhaps this could be something that may be measurable. But it is important to include third order hydrodynamics, otherwise you get the wrong result here. For example, in a sound mode, this is sort of more heavily suppressed and probably not so accessible. One may sort of wonder whether this is measurable, perhaps. Now, there are various other issues regarding hydrodynamics that I will not discuss, but I think it's important to keep in mind that these are sort of unsolved problems. So we know that when you start including loop corrections to compute stress-energy tensor two-point function or things like this, the analyticity of the hydrodynamic expansion in omega and k is broken. So this goes under the name of long time tails. So from the point of view of holography, this is not such a pressing issue because, as it was shown by Kofton and Jaffer, these long time tails are suppressed by 1 over n. And in holography, you know, we normally take n equals from n goes to infinity limit because that's the easiest thing to study. So this is not such a problem. But in general, I think it's not completely well known how this behaves. And, you know, there's a certain open issue how these long time tails behave with respect to higher order hydrodynamics and things like this. Then there's a whole issue of the entropy current, and the entropy current imposes extra constraints on transport coefficients. I will come back to this issue later, which is also important. Then recently, we only started sort of discovering non-relativistic hydrodynamics. You know, there's much more than just looking at hydrodynamics with Galilean symmetries. For example, Lifshitz symmetries, Schrodinger symmetries. This is an active topic of research these days. Then, of course, there's the issue of how one actually derives hydrodynamics from a microscopic quantum field theory. And there's also been a lot of research done recently on this topic. So this kind of started with Alberto Nicolis and Damson writing down some simple effective action for non-dissipative hydrodynamics. Then we showed with Janos Polonyi that one can add dissipation into the system if you promote this theory to Schwinger-Keldysh formalism. And now this has been sort of expanded vastly, and there's been a lot of beautiful work done by these groups, Ram Mukund Rangamani, Jan de Boer, Hong Liu. People have really now generalized this formalism, and we wait to see what will happen now. So with this introduction, now I want to go to my first application and see what we can say about magnetohydrodynamics. So what is magnetohydrodynamics? It's a theory of hydrodynamics of charged matter. Okay, very simple. So what I will use is the concept of generalized global symmetries in order to fully classify magnetohydrodynamics. Now, the first question is the question of what are the global symmetries of magnetohydrodynamics? So there's the issue of what are gauge symmetries and what are global U1 symmetries in the problem. Now, a normal expression like this that we have in, you know, electrodynamics is a manifestation of the local symmetry. What we claim is the correct thing to look at is the U1 symmetry of the following thing. So let me first think about standard case where you have charged particles in your system. Now, you know that if you want to count the number of charged particles going through your system in four space-time dimensions, you can build a three-surface, and you can look at how many of them are going through. So the number of these particles going through such a surface is conserved. Okay. Now, in a system with magnetic fields as well, what is actually conserved in the real world is the number of magnetic field lines crossing a two-surface. So this is what we claim is the correct U1 symmetry in such a problem to classify. So this is, as I said, this is associated with these generalized global symmetries and the symmetries that look like this. So what is important here is that this number of magnetic flux lines that is conserved. You should also note that, you know, in real life, when you have electrons, the number of electric flux lines is not conserved. So this symmetry, this one-form symmetry of the number of flux lines crossing a surface, is encoded in a conserved two-form current. And in terms of the normal language of electrodynamics, this is the Bianchi identity. So what I want to do is now classify my hydrodynamics that has a conserved stress-energy tensor, which is a symmetric two-tensor, and an anti-symmetric two-tensor, which in normal QED is conserved by the Bianchi identity, but I can now treat it as the true infrared global symmetry around which I want to organize my universal effective physics. So this is exactly what we did. Now, in order to do this, one can go through the standard procedure of classifying hydrodynamics. So because now we have more equations, these equations, I need extra fields. So the new fields are the following. So I still have a four vector, the velocity of my fluid. There's a temperature field. Now I need a new vector field, which you can think of as associated with the presence of a vector magnetic field. Although H is not exactly the magnetic field, it's a hydrodynamic variable. But we can see that, you know, if you pick a very a flow with just one preferred direction, then the direction of the magnetic field will be proportional to the direction of H. And H is normalized to 1, like this. So we also need an extra chemical potential. And this is a chemical potential associated with the number, the conservation of magnetic flux lines. OK, so now I can write down my ideal hydrodynamics like this. This is the most general thing at zero number of derivatives that this expansion can take. So this is anti-symmetrized. And now there's sort of new associated thermodynamics with such a system that goes like this. Sort of, you know, this is just a small perturbation on the general topic. Now, what I can immediately look at is, even at the level of ideal hydrodynamics, are what are the modes of such a system. So what comes out are the usual results of normal magnetohydrodynamics. In fact, what we find are the Alphen waves and the slow and fast magnetosonic waves. So the dispersion relation for them both look like they all look like a sound mode. So the first one is an Alphen wave. And the dispersion relation now, this V squared A, is some curly V squared A. And this V is now a general function of my energy density and pressure. So there's no assumption here on the equation of state. And this is the key. I don't have to assume weakly coupled electrodynamics. I don't have to assume Maxwell's equations, because we know that in strongly coupled matter, they will get corrected. And this is now true for any theory, as long as later I can provide some kind of an equation of state in the sense that I was talking about on my first slide. If I can provide the microscopic input, then whatever this theory is, this should describe such a magnetized fluid in the infrared, whatever the coupling. So these Alphen waves are some kind of an interpolation between diffusion and sound. So this theta measures the angle between my fluid flow direction and the magnetic field. So at theta equals to 0, when they're aligned, this is a sound mode. And when they're at right angles, this is a diffusive mode, because this leading order term goes to 0. So this is sort of important in solar physics and things like this. And Alphen got a Nobel Prize for this discovery of this wave. Now, there are a second type of waves, which are called the magnetosonic waves. There are two types of these, because this Vm, you can see there's a plus and a minus. So the ones with the plus here are called the fast magnetosonic waves, and the ones with the minus are slow. And these are sort of sound modes propagating through the magnetized plasma. Again, we have now a completely general expression for such a wave. And these functions are very complicated functions of my energy density and all the microscopic input of the fluid that is required to describe such a thing. Okay, so we can look at how this theory fits in with normal magnetohydrodynamics. So what we can do is assume high temperature compared to the density of magnetic flux lines. So this is a weak field limit in the normal language of physics. So in the weak field limit, you can take your pressure and expand it in such a series. Now, if you only keep the first two terms and you plug this in now into the setup that I prepared, what you get is precisely the standard magnetohydrodynamics that people have been talking about for a very long time. So with the choice of the equation of state that is given from weakly coupled QED, you recover all the known results of magnetohydrodynamics. But of course, because you know now this is valid for anything, we can start correcting these things by just doing a Taylor expansion in relevant parameters and studying sort of new physics of magnetized plasmas. We can also look at the strong field limit, where T is very small. So this is now me sending temperature to zero. And I can do another kind of an expansion and you know look at what how my plasma behaves. So typically in this field of work, one plots velocity diagrams of the different speeds. So these guys here are called, so these are the fast magnetosonic waves, the solid line are the alpha waves, and this line are slow magnetosonic waves. And this is plotted as a function of the angle between magnetic field and the fluid velocity. So you can observe some new features in such a thing. Of course, what you really want to do with this theory depends on the question, the physical question that you want to answer. And so far, I'm just preparing the setup. This was just the ideal part of the story. Now I can go beyond and do what I did before with normal hydro and classify derivative corrections. So it turns out that to first order, there are 11 terms you can write down, but not all of them are consistent with positive definite entropy production. So if you now compute this entropy current from hydrodynamics, what you find is that only 6 transport coefficients survive. So in terms of standard intuition of hydro, this is exactly because magnetic field breaks isotropy of the fluid. So we now have 2 shear viscosities, 2 bulk viscosities, and 2 resistivities. One can be, one is sort of proportional to the magnetic field, and the other one is perpendicular to the magnetic field. These transport coefficients, which can be any function of the equations, of the microscopics. So I can write down this thing again, and I can compute the correction to alpha waves. And this is the most general dissipative, first-order dissipative correction to alpha waves. Okay. Now, what is interesting about this setup is that the transport coefficients that come into the two-form J are resistivities and not conductivities. So if you do normal hydrodynamics of a conserved baryon number or something like this, what you find are conductivities. But in our language, they're resistivities. So in terms of this dualized language of the two form, R is the most natural thing to study. So we can write down Kubo formulae for these transport coefficients. And what we can show is that in the limit of, if we assume weakly coupled QED, we can show that this R is, as one would expect, 1 over sigma, where sigma is the conductivity. However, if you do this now in this dual two-form language, there are sort of new diagrams that contribute, and it's not exactly clear, or probably it's clear that the resistivity computed out of this will not equal to 1 over the conductivity. So this is this is an interesting question of what exactly is happening here. So we do see that, in normal QED, R is 1 over sigma, but in general, this may not need to be so. So this is one of the physical implications of this formalism that remains to be studied. We should see what exactly is going on here. So another limit that we can take and see if we can write down some universal description is really take temperature to strictly zero. Now, in normal hydrodynamics, this is not a very healthy thing to do because what is hydrodynamics at zero temperature? But it turns out that in magnetohydrodynamics, if we do take T strictly to zero, we can write down a consistent theory of hydrodynamics, and this is a very new thing, I guess. Now, what we will do is, because we want to really work at zero temperature, then it's clear that there can be no entropy whatsoever associated to such a system. There can be no entropy production. So we will take an even stronger condition and not just set T to zero, but also set delta T. So there are no fluctuations in the temperature field. So there is really a reduction in the number of degrees of freedom. Now, what is important to consider is that in a normal magnetohydrodynamic system at finite temperature, the symmetry, the usual Poincaré symmetry, is broken down to SO2. First to SO3 by a choice of the velocity field, and then by another vector, which is the magnetic field, is broken to SO2. Now at zero temperature, this SO2 symmetry is enhanced by boosts along the magnetic field lines. So what we claim is that the correct symmetry to consider is SO11 cross SO2. So what I want to do now is, you know, formulate new hydrodynamics at strictly zero temperature, large magnetic field, in terms of these new degrees of freedom that have to be invariant under this symmetry. So the tensorial structures are the following. We have an antisymmetric two tensor, U. There's no more velocity field in such a theory because there's only an antisymmetric two form. And because we normalize it to -2, there's also now a chemical potential still. So there's, okay, so these are the new degrees of freedom. And I can, again, go through the whole procedure of hydrodynamics and see if I can write down a consistent theory. So indeed we can. So we can write down a stress energy tensor and a J in terms of these quantities. They're defined like that. So this omega is a symmetric SO11 projector. So this thing always projects onto the SO11. And this pi is, well, transverse to that. So what is interesting here is that because we have a reduction of degrees of freedom, it may seem like we cannot close our system, because the number of equations is still the same as it was before. So T mu nu, the conservation will give you four equations, and the conservation of this guy will, again, still formally give you four equations. But I have now only an antisymmetric two tensor, which is what, 6 degrees of freedom with 2 constraints. So that's 4, yes. So I have 4 plus 1, 5 in total, and 8 equations coming from there. What is quite interesting here is that, okay, so the zeroth component of the conservation of J is a constraint in the same way as it was before. But 2 equations are knocked out by a very similar equation that normally gives you zero entropy. Sorry, that it gives you the conservation of entropy. So if you consider this expression, which is equivalent to imposing conservation of entropy at zeroth order hydrodynamics, you can see that 2 extra equations are knocked out, so the system is able to close. Okay, so it's all consistent. And now we can again study what happens in such a theory. So this system with these fields and this setup has, again, Alphen waves, and Alphen waves in this limit turn out to be completely universal. So there are no dissipative corrections whatsoever to this Alphen wave. It remains exact to all orders. There are still fast magnetosonic waves, which do get corrected, but there are no slow magnetosonic waves. This is because delta T is set to zero. So this is the system now, and we can again study dissipative corrections. Sorry, well, higher order corrections to this. There's no dissipation, so this means that just by looking at tensorial structures, there's no way to construct anything at first order in hydrodynamic expansion.
See, I'm finding myself a little lost here. Mm-hmm. Right? Is all this classical up to now? There's no
H-bar? There's no
H-bar.
So H-bar, I mean, what is quantum are equations of state. Things that feed into energy density, pressure, you know, that kind of stuff can depend on the coupling constant and quantum physics.
Usually to get the equations to close, you have to assume local equilibrium.
That's...
So where was that?
This assumption of local equilibrium is somehow in the assumption of what kind of fields I take. You know, I take one function that describes my temperature, weakly fluctuating temperature, that kind of thing.
But then there would be an entropy associated with the local equilibrium.
And then I also compute the entropy current. That, yes, okay. That we do as well, yeah, sure. So you can say that, maybe that's the statement that you're looking for. We do compute the entropy current using the standard techniques and then make it zero in this case, because there's no temperature. Okay? So the question now is, okay, we have a setup, we have a formalism. What are the, you know, physical questions that we want to study? So we already have some predictions, as for example, what happens to the behavior of modes at low temperature? Is this measurable? Then, of course, the next step is to select experimentally interesting systems where we know equations of state and where we know transport coefficients and look at what happens in such systems. And then, of course, the question is, you know, what can we really learn about real plasma physics and nuclear heavy ion collisions in the presence of strong magnetic fields? Because this is the kind of regime that was normally not describable by standard magnetohydrodynamics. You know, then the question of what happens to chiral magnetic effect, and, you know, can we use holography, for example, to gain some insight into what magnetohydrodynamics is doing at strong coupling? But sort of this remains open as a... Yeah?
Can you take it, what was the non-standard part?
The non-standard part? That this is true for any equation of state. There's no assumption. So normally, in the normal language, when people construct magnetohydrodynamics, what they do is they take Navier-Stokes equations and they take Maxwell's equations, and then they combine them. And there's the assumption there of weakly coupled physics, because otherwise Maxwell's equations are not correct. You know that, you know, even in standard QED, the next correction is, I don't know, the Euler-Heisenberg-Lagrangian, and the Maxwell's equations are not true anymore. So we avoid any discussion of Maxwell's equations by just classifying symmetries. And then we let microscopics decide the equation of state and transport coefficients. Okay? That. Okay, so now I keep talking about this combination of microscopics and effective field theory. So for me, in this part of the talk, holography will be the thing that provides my microscopic input, because we know that, well, holography is a nice model that allows me to study models of strongly coupled physics. So I will assume that you know all about this, that you know how this works. And from my point of view, as I already said, holography is a nice way of studying some well-defined strongly coupled field theory. And, you know, this is a sort of a statement of duality. The question that I want to address is, what is universal at strong coupling? And can holography tell us something about what happens at strong coupling? And in particular, because holography is most naturally suited at studying actually field theories at infinite coupling, can we use holography to say something about going away from infinite coupling? Now, in holography, one normally takes two limits. The number of colors n goes to infinity. So I will not touch this in the rest of the talk, because this is a whole separate issue and this is very difficult. One needs to compute, quantum gravity corrections. But in order to go beyond infinite Hoeft coupling, this is easier, and we can study higher derivative gravities to do this. So this is exactly what I'm going to do.
And h-bar is still equal to zero?
H-bar is 1 over n.
So there's a classical notion of holography.
This is the usual holography, yes. I mean, it's an infinite n theory. So yes, you get this factorization of correlation functions. So really, it's classical. As classical as infinite n field theories are. So what we know from holography already is that low energy QFTs are very nicely described by low energy fluctuations of gravitational backgrounds. So if I want to study my hydrodynamics of the dual theory, as you know, it has been already very nicely established, is I take my holographic gravity theory, say my five-dimensional Einstein-Hilbert theory, I find a black hole solution, I take it, I perturb it, and then I study the correlation functions that arise from the response of my gravitational fluctuations. Okay, so what we know is that, you know, one can write down a nice expansion of an expectation value of some operator. This is just linear response theory generalized to higher order response. So what I can compute from looking at linear response in standard field theory are two-point functions. Now, if I want to compute what happens in higher-order hydrodynamics, two-point functions are not enough. So in order to compute second-order transport coefficients, I need three-point functions. In order to compute third-order transport coefficients, I need all four-point functions, and so on. So this holography is very well suited for. What is even easier to do in holography is to study the quasi-normal modes of the gravitational spectrum and just read off the poles of the correlators of these guys and find what the dispersion relations are. So this I will also be doing in part of my talk. So let's start with the simplest example.
Sorry.
Yeah.
What is GRA in poles, right?
That was some one point.
The second one, this one.
This one?
Yeah.
Ah. Okay, sorry. Yes, these are the, this is a retarded two-point function. So this discusses, so these A's and R's are insertions. So this is just a normal retarded two-point function. What is actually important is that this one is AAR. So this is a fully retarded three-point function. You know, there are many different three-point functions in real time. And this, the ones that come into such an expansion are the ones that are called fully retarded. So really, each operator is ordered in a retarded way. This is what I mean by this. That's a very good question. Okay, so I'm starting with the simplest thing. Type 2B theory on S5 is dual to n equals to 4 supersymmetric Young-Mills at infinite Toft coupling and infinite n. So when this is compactified on S5, if I'm just interested in what happens to the energy momentum sector, this is the theory that I need to study. So the Newton's constant here is related to 1 over nc, so formally it's 0. Okay, this theory has a simple black brain solution that everyone knows, and I can now use this theory to study my dual hydrodynamics. So I can compute first order, second order transport coefficients. This was already known. Now we can also compute some of the third order transport coefficients, for example. And these are the results. So this is holography now providing me with necessary input that I can plug into my hydrodynamics to close all the equations and get all the well-defined results. So it goes like that. So eta over s, importantly, in this setup is 1 over 4 pi. Now I can move away from infinite coupling and consider higher derivative supergravity corrections. And this is because the coupling constants that come into higher derivative gravity pieces are proportional to alpha prime, so higher powers of alpha prime in the stringy expansion. And alpha prime is proportional via holographic dictionary to 1 over the Toft coupling to 1/2. So if I now go through standard holography and I compute corrections in these higher derivative pieces, I can find Toft coupling corrections around infinite coupling to my dual field theory. And this is exactly what I'm going to do. So there's a top-down construction. It involves this tensor. So it's some contractions of Weyl to the 4 tensors. And this is known from supergravity. I can do a reduction, again, on S5 and come to a five-dimensional action. Now, this thing remains the same. So this tensor is now scalar. It can be written like this, but now in five dimensions. The details don't really matter right now. What is important is that these are higher derivative theories. So this is Riemann to the 4th, which means that it's... So if this is a two-derivative piece in the action, this is an eight-derivative piece in the supergravity action. Okay, so this thing has a known black brain solution solved perturbatively in alpha prime. And I can, again, go and compute all the hydrodynamics. Okay, so what is important here is that eta over s gets a correction that's positive. So it's 1 over 4 pi plus something. And there's no choice in the sign. Now, if I go to a slightly more bottom-up higher derivative theory, what I can write down is the most general curvature squared correction that looks like this. And if I treat these couplings perturbatively, I can again compute all the necessary transport coefficients that I want. But what is nice about such a theory is that if I construct the couplings in such a way that they're 1, minus 4, and 1, then this is known as the Gauss-Bonnet theory. And the special property of such a theory, in four dimensions, this is a topological term. It doesn't do anything to classical equations of motion. But in five dimensions, what it does is it gives me second derivative equations of motion. So in principle, I can treat such a theory non-perturbatively in the coupling. And it will be quite instructive to look at this. So what we can do now is compute all first and all second order transport coefficients, and even one of the third order transport coefficients, non-perturbatively in the coupling. The important feature here is that eta over s, depending on what the sign of lambda GB is, can be either more or less than 1 over 4 pi. So this was, you know, as the story of the 1 over 4 pi bound goes, this was the example of how one is able to violate such a bound. So what I want to mention now is the concept of universality that I'll be using. So what we mean by universality, yes?
I guess the center relation here, but is the bound, can the bound actually be violated? Is it consistent to take lambda to be negative?
So there are examples you have to take it to be positive. So one can treat these things as more like 1 over n corrections, and there's this SP2n theory by Katz and Petrov, where the natural sign is positive. And in such a case, probably yes. Although I don't know if, you know, it's not completely clear to me if those are really all 1 over n corrections that one needs to add to eta over s. So I don't know if this is the full answer. What I will argue is that from the point of view of looking at lambda gb as a coupling constant, it's more natural to take it to be negative. And I will discuss this later in terms of the thermalization spectra. So this will be important.
Sorry, later. What was the result of the top-down case? You didn't violate it perturbatively? The part where you actually have an alpha prime cubed correction that's honest.
Yeah, it's always plus. Plus 15 Riemann zeta function of 3 lambda to minus 3 halves. Yeah, so it's always positive. Okay, so we talk about universality quite a lot in holography. This word is abused very heavily. What I mean when I say this word is that in the holographic construction, there always exists a conserved current. So there is some kind of a current that's radially conserved. So in order for me to compute the necessary observable, if I can relate this observable to such a current, I can now compute it from the horizon only. I don't need to know everything about the dynamics in 5 dimensions. So all these universality cases are always associated to such conserved currents. So the most prominent is in first order hydrodynamics, eta over s being 1 over 4 pi. And this has been proven to be true in all possible 2 derivative theories that don't break, you know, I don't know, isotropy of the system and things like this. So in second order hydrodynamics, there's a completely equivalent statement to this. And the statement is that a particular linear combination of transport coefficients equals to 0. And it was proven by Huck and Yarom that this is true for the same class of theories as eta over s being 1 over 4 pi. What we also showed with Andreas Darinets is that in all these curvature squared and curvature to the fourth theories, actually, this is the universality statement here is stronger. So it's also true to the leading order expansion in the coupling. It's not true non-perturbatively. So if you compute this relation non-perturbatively in Gauss-Bonnet theory, it's not true. It's, if you then expand it in small lambda GB, it's violated at second order. Okay? So it looks like, you know, maybe, I don't know if there's any sort of physical reason for this, but it kind of looks like that in higher order hydrodynamics, there's even more universality. It's not only true at infinite coupling. And this is quite interesting. There's also a very, very strong case of universality that we now have established in holography. I will not have time to talk about this. But if you're interested in anomalous chiral transport, so these are conductivities that are associated to the presence of anomalies in your system, what we can now prove is that there are 4 conductivities associated to this. These go under the name of chiral magnetic effect and chiral vortical effect and chiral separation effect, and the 4th one I don't think has a name, at least not one that I know. So what we can prove now from holography is that these conductivities, all 4 of them, are completely universal in any theory. In any theory, as long as the bulk conserves, so as long as the bulk is diffeomorphism and gauge invariant, we can really show that no matter what the Lagrangian is, as long as, you know, there's some well-defined, healthy black brain solution and an asymptotic anti-de Sitter space, these 4 transport coefficients are always constrained by anomalies. So this we proved recently. So this is a very, very strong statement of universality. And in some ways, this is kind of a check that holography behaves in the way it should. Because we know from field theory that these things should be really severely constrained by non-renormalization theorems of anomalies. But I will not have time to go into the details of this now. So I will skip this section. And because that's a slightly tangential of applications of this universality to disordered transport. And I will now go beyond hydrodynamics and discuss how, going to weak coupling, we can learn new things about transport in strongly coupled field theories. So what I'm interested now is going, so hydrodynamics you should think of as the really the extreme low energy effective field theory. Now I want to look at higher frequency spectra and see what happens to my systems still at finite temperature, what happens to their thermalization and relaxation properties. So this we studied with Andrei Starinets and Nikos Kaplis. And so one of the reasons that we were motivated to study such a thing is because these relaxation properties in CFTs have had a very long history. So there's an interesting statement that kinetic theory makes. So if you look at kinetic theory, one can sort of show that shear viscosity is proportional to some number, I'm calling it 1 here, times the relaxation time, whatever that may be for now. So some relaxation time that characterizes the time scale of how quickly my system relaxes, times entropy, density, times the temperature. So this is a result from kinetic theory, which can only be corrected at weak coupling by construction of the Boltzmann equation. Now, there's also a very long history of discussion on what happens to these relaxation times. So, you know, this perhaps, I don't know the entire history of this, of the relaxation time bounds, but sort of it was made quite precise by Sachdev by studying this in various CFT models. And the statement here is that this relaxation time should be bounded from below by some order of 1 number C that I cannot specify, that depends on the system, times h bar over kbt. Yes?
What's the definition of the relaxation time?
I will get to that. It's the time it takes for a system to relax. Sorry, I will try to avoid tautologies. So one way how one can see what this should really be is to study a theory that we can really study very well. So in condensed matter literature, this is one plus one dimensional Ising model. The transverse Ising model is a CFT, and one can compute all sorts of things exactly. So you can open Sachdev's book, and you can find all the results that you need about such a system. Now, because this is a 1 plus 1 dimensional CFT, if you now consider a dual of a 1 plus 1 dimensional CFT, the dual is a 3 dimensional BTZ black hole. And you can compute also correlation function from holography. What you can see is that CFT is sufficiently constraining that if you compute a two-point function for any dimension scalar operator, you get some result. Okay. If you now, so this agrees exactly with the calculation from the Ising model for this dimension of the operator equaling to 1/8, which is the dimension of the transverse spin in the Ising model. So anyhow, this is not important right now, but what is important is that for such a system, we have an exact two-point function from holography. So because we have an exact two-point function, I can look at all the modes of such a system. So these are analytically dispersion relations of this whole system, and they're sort of, these are the relations. So the way I will now define my relaxation time is for it to be, so I can associate one relaxation time with each mode. And so normally, if you're familiar with holography literature, we draw diagrams like this. So we draw a complex, you probably cannot see anything. it's okay, I don't think that's the reason why they can't see anything.
No, that helps a lot, yeah.
Oh, it does?
Leave it on.
Sorry. So if you can see this, so I can draw a complex omega plane, and then on the complex omega plane, I can fix my, let me fix my momentum k to something, to some number, and then I can look at what are the singularities in the Green's function for this. So I can draw the spectrum. And so this is dual to the calculation of quasi-normal modes in holography. So normally I get a diagram that looks like a Christmas tree. And maybe there's some excitations on, like hydro excitations here. What is important is that now in this Ising model, I know the position of all the excitations in the system. So I'm going to define my tau as the inverse of the imaginary part of my mode. So tau for a particular mode is defined as 1 over the imaginary of omega. Okay, this is my definition. Okay, sorry, can I, where do I, here. Okay, just on the topic of definitions. So I can now compute all the tau r's for all the excitations in this system. And this is the result. Okay, so this is just to give you some intuition of what kind of stuff I'm interested in. Yes?
The answer presumably depends on the operator of this two-point function.
Yeah, so this is the dimension of the operator, of the scalar operator.
So the bound by Sashtra, how is it universal? It depends on the operator.
It depends on the C. So C is some order one number that depends on the system. So it depends, so in the Ising model, you have a phase diagram like this. So you know these are the results. So it's some value. For example, here it's e to the delta over kb squared. So yes, it depends on the operator. But it's some number. It's not, you know. Yeah?
It's not a number, it's a function of the dimension.
Well, for a given dimension, it's a number.
I mean, the extreme theory of the spectral dimensions is first.
And it's a CFT, so there's no other scale except the temperature. So isn't it clear that the answer is 1 over the temperature?
No. But because there's a D, sorry, delta.
Delta is not seeing that in the postmodern.
The relaxation time band, what could you have except 1 over D?
Oh, this part is dimensional analysis, yeah.
Yes.
Sure. The claim that it's bounded from below by an order one number times dimensional analysis is highly non-trivial. Okay? Because it could be zero. But it's not zero. Okay, so this is what I was drawing before. So now we want to tune our coupling constant in a four-dimensional theory and see what happens. So at zero coupling, typically in the spectrum, like what I drew here, we expect branch cuts, okay? And at infinite coupling, as we have learned from holography, we expect isolated poles. Okay, so the question is, how does one go from another, and you know, what happens to the behavior of these guys that control my relaxation in the system? So this is what we studied, and what we find are qualitatively sort of results that okay, there are several results. I'm going to describe them. So what we do is now study such as the theories that I showed you before. So we do the top-down construction of the actual alpha prime corrections in n equals to 4 theory, and we also study the most general curvature square theories and Gauss-Bonnet theory non-perturbatively and the coupling, all sorts of all of these theories. What they show are very, very similar, sort of, I would say, the same qualitative features of how these poles, how the singularities move around as I tune my coupling from infinite coupling to weak coupling. So there are two different qualitative trends, and they depend on eta over s. This is something we see. Now, what I'm calling a healthy limit, the weak limit, is, so this gamma was the n equals to 4 coupling, which has only one direction. So one can only tune it in one direction. And all the qualitative results of really tuning a theory to weak coupling in n equals to 4 are reproduced by tuning the Gauss-Bonnet coupling to negative values. So this is the trend. So the trends behave in the same way in all these theories for which eta over s goes above 1 over 4 pi. Now, in Gauss-Bonnet theory, in these curvature square theories, you can also tune the coupling, this lambda GB, to be positive. You can go all the way to 1/4 formally. And this is, I mean, the features that we observe are highly anomalous. So this doesn't look like a very healthy limit. So at least from the point of view of studying these things, it looks like eta over s should go above 1 over 4 pi in order for you to have a healthy CFT. So now let me explain exactly what I mean by this. So for theories for which eta over s is above 1 over 4 pi with dimensions reinstated, what we observe are that these poles in the Christmas tree, they generically come closer and closer together, and the two branches move upwards. When we tune eta over s down from 1 over 4 pi, what you observe is the opposite behavior. So these quasi-normal modes sort of become further and further apart, and they eventually move out. So they move off the plane, off the whole complex omega plane, and none are left. So the reason why I'm calling this anomalous is because now if I associate a relaxation time to each one of these modes, it would seem that this limit in which eta over s goes to zero also can take the relaxation time to zero. And this, you know, would violate any kind of a bound, any kind of a such type bound on relaxation times. So this doesn't look very healthy. So this is one observation that we have made. Now, the next thing is because these poles come closer and closer together, you qualitatively observe emergence of branch cuts that are sort of, you know, straightened out. And another thing that supports this is you expect such a branch cut to start at omega equals to plus minus k and to go to infinity, and this is exactly what you see from holography emerging as you tune the coupling constant. Okay? Now, another important feature for my discussion of hydrodynamics is that as we tune the coupling constant away from infinite coupling, we see emergence of new excitations on the imaginary axis. So these are purely relaxational modes, and you will see now what they do to hydrodynamics. So before I get there, I can show you some actual results. So for n equals 4, this is what happens to the actual modes. This is a numerical calculation. And these couplings, gamma, this is the coupling that comes into the Lagrangian, they're kept fairly small. So already at 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the minus 3, which is, you know, kind of perturbative, we observe all sorts of features in the spectrum. So in the Gauss-Bonnet theory, all these features can be seen much more in a much more pronounced way because we can treat the theory non-perturbatively. So, you know, you can see sort of an emergence of a thing that looks like a branch cut, and all these things move around. Now, what is important is that I started this whole story by saying that kinetic theory predicts that eta over s should be a constant times tau times t. And if we plot in all these theories exactly this ratio, so here I'm plotting eta over s times tau times t, what we see is that as we move, so this Gauss-Bonnet coupling is now, you know, at zero value, the dual theory is infinitely coupled. So if I move towards greater and greater negative lambda Gauss-Bonnet, these things straighten out very quickly. So holography really reproduces very quickly what you would expect from weakly coupled kinetic theory. Whereas around infinite coupling, the behavior is completely different. So this is another feature that we observe. Now, another feature, yet another thing, that you would observe normally in weakly coupled field theories are quasiparticles. In holography, we know we don't have any quasiparticles. So the spectral function looks something like this. But now, because these poles are moving closer and closer to the real axis, if I compute my spectral function, I observe an emergence of well-defined narrow peaks. And, you know, I mean, this looks a lot like a quasiparticle. This looks exactly what the quasiparticle would look like in a spectral function. So this is also nicely reproduced from holography. Yes?
The statement is you have quasiparticles as long as you go slightly away from infinity.
I don't know about slightly, but yeah.
But you just did a couple of orders.
This is a non-perturbative calculation, but you do see them, yeah. I mean, they come quickly. Although quantifying what is quickly is difficult.
Can you go back to the previous slide?
Which slide?
The previous. Yeah,
Oh,
I see. It's not perturbative.
Yeah, but same thing happens in, this is just a nicer example, but the same thing happens in a perturbative case too. They flatten out these things very quickly.
So the statement is if the coupling is large, so you spend a couple orders and one over the coupling, and then you already reproduce.
Even one, yeah. The statement is that you very quickly reproduce things that you would expect from weakly coupled field theory out of holography. Surprisingly quickly.
In first order and perturbation theory?
Yeah, which is surprising. Because if you do a QFT calculation to first order in the coupling, you don't expect strongly coupled physics. But we do see all these features emerging from such a simple calculation. And this is, I guess, one of the surprises here. So we can also now compute all the two-point functions. And I want to end this by discussing what happens to hydrodynamics. So you would expect that, again, from just general intuition, that as you go to weak coupling, you know, your mean free sort of the time between collisions in your gas becomes very large. So you would expect hydrodynamics to eventually break down. So hydrodynamics becomes a worse and worse description of your infrared physics at weak coupling. So now with holography, we can sort of quantify what this actually means. So I told you that we see an emergence of new poles on the imaginary axis. So now let me look at diffusion, okay? So you know that diffusion has a purely imaginary dispersion relation, minus I dk squared plus higher order corrections. So what happens is that this diffusion pole, now as I tune the coupling constant, moves down. And my new new excitation comes up, they collide, and they move off the axis. So my hydrodynamic excitation is completely destroyed. If I keep my momentum fixed, for fixed momentum, I can always bring the coupling constant such that this will happen. And I can quantify this value by calling this value of where the two things collide as the critical point where my hydrodynamics breaks down. And I can show that by doing calculation around this regime close to the real axis, what we can show is that this critical momentum is proportional to the Hooft coupling to 3/4. So what this is saying is sort of it's quantifying what you would expect. So as you make your coupling constant in the theory small, the radius of convergence, if you like, the range of validity of hydrodynamics shrinks. It becomes only valid for very, very small momenta and energies. And this is the statement and that one can now quantify in such a way. So similar things happen in the sound mode. And this is sort of roughly what it looks like. So for the sound mode, because sound has two poles, omega equals to plus minus the speed of sound times k, they start here. And they move outwards, the two sound poles. So the two sound poles actually join with the two Christmas trees, and they become the leading pole in this straight line. And you have a new mode that comes up. And what happens here is that the new mode overtakes the sound mode. So you cannot anymore expect that the sound mode will be the correct description of your low energy limit of the theory, because there's now another mode that is at lower energies. And the point where these things cross is precisely at the same point as where the diffusion pole collides with the new mode. So these poles seem to be the same in all the channels of the theory. Okay, so just to conclude this whole thing, this was, you know, all done in sort of linear perturbation sense. I was looking at weak perturbations of my hydrodynamic system and studying linear operators and things like this, studying two-point functions. What we now did with Wilke van der Schee from MIT was to study the full sort of holographic story of what is dual to heavy ion collisions. So a holographic model of heavy ion collisions, what you do is you do the following. On the boundary, you take two thin pancake-like profiles of energy density, and you smash them together. So this is, you know, this came from the work that was originated in Seattle, the group in Seattle. So one can do this and then study what happens to such a system. Now, again, what we did with Wilke was to include curvature squared corrections. So we can show that now as we tune the curvature squared corrections, what we observe are the nuclei experience less stopping and more energy is deposited near the light cone. What we observe is less entropy production. But what is the most important for my part of the story is the following. So what we know from these heavy ion collisions and from holography is that such a system, very, very quickly after the collision, sort of roughly within one Fermi time, becomes very well described by hydrodynamics. And if you do holography, you know, you see that this is really the case. It just becomes, you know, immediately after the collision. If you now do a dual modeling of this system via Navier-Stokes equations, you see exactly the same evolution of your energy and pressure. So what we observe now is that this hydrodynamization time, the time after the collision at which my hydrodynamic description of the system becomes good, increases with coupling constant corrections. So, you know, all the qualitative features that you would want in going from strong coupling the weak coupling are reproduced, so you know things move with the right sign. I guess this is the main message of the paper. And then what we want to do now is, you know, really go and study physics, like real physics, at intermediate coupling, because we know that, you know, actual experiments don't happen at infinite coupling. So we hope that, you know, now that we have some handle over introducing coupling constant corrections to this whole story of holography, we can go and, you know, use our strongly coupled results from holography and weakly coupled results and do some kind of interpolation and study quantitatively even physics of heavy ions and things like this. And yes, with this, I would like to thank you for your attention.
What's the relaxation time as a function of the coupling? I mean, of lambda.
So it goes. So as a function of the coupling, so what I claim to be the healthy limit, these things move up, so the relaxation time goes down. Sorry, goes up. Sorry. The relaxation time increases as a function of the coupling. It takes longer for the system to
equilibrate. Does it still go like one over the temperature?
No, not necessarily.
What's the functional form?
I don't know. This is numerical. We cannot study the behavior of this analytically for n equals to 4 theory.
Sashdev had a conjecture that whenever the relaxation time scales like 1 over the temperature with some order 1 number, then there cannot, will not be quasi particles. So if you were to show that in the regime where you increase lambda and you show you do have quasi particles, that you were to then see the relaxation time.
Okay.
Temperature,
I need to look into this. I don't think it's falsified in this case. No. Yeah.
This question's probably a little bit naive, but if you consider something like QCD or more generally some Mazatoki free theory, when you constructed your hydrodynamic stuff in the very first part of your talk, you took only the stress tensor as the conserved current.
Yeah.
The appearance of potentially higher spin conserved things, are these, though, if you put these in and thought about them, are they sub-leading?
Higher spin conserved? Sorry, what do you mean?
If you just take a free theory, it's going to have higher spin conserved currents.
Oh, okay.
And so that when you, I guess, collide these things, it's not really free, but it's probably free because it's very high energy. But are those higher spin things that you might expect to be there?
We haven't looked at this kind of thing. I don't know. So there are some statements that in order to make a Gauss-Bonnet calculation healthy, you would need to include higher spin theories into the bulk. Higher spin fields in the bulk to make sense of these higher derivative theories. Now, it's possible that once you have such a thing in the theory, it will source a dual operator, which will be higher spin. So perhaps as you go to zero coupling, you may see some dynamical emergence of such operators. But I cannot say anything intelligent about this right now. It's an interesting question. I don't know. Perhaps. It's not been studied. I mean, it's clearly not. Nothing has been done on this.
Okay.